Okay, perfect. All right. Thank you, everyone. I'm very sorry to have missed this great opportunity to meet with you and see face to face with all the great experts and audience. I want to especially thank Greg, Steph, Lenny, Herman, and Mark for putting together this timely and exciting forum. Their long-time work and commitment to labor and social movements and social justice has been a continual inspiration for my own work. As Lenny has noted, a large and growing wave of worker strikes and protests have rocked China in recent years. How to make sense of this ongoing working class resistance, its forms, expressions, potentials, and limits in China? And what are the implications of Chinese workers' struggles for activists and socialists in China and in other countries? In my book, I try to engage with this question by exploring the current conditions, subjectivity, and active actions of workers in the world's largest and fastest growing automobile manufacturing nation. Underlying my research agenda is a deep interest in the forms, mechanisms, and subjective experience of worker agency and working class power. How ordinary working men and women assert their rights and gain some control and dignity at work. How they interact with those who hold power, that is, the state and the capital, and attempt to improve their work and living conditions. It is important to think the debate on our struggles in China from the bottom up, starting with the perspective of workers and their experience. To be sure, worker agency and their actions are shaped in a dialogical interaction with evolution of global capitalism and specific structured and contextual factors. Therefore, I try to combine ethnographic studies of activities and consciousness with a long-time and a dynamic approach, one that emphasizes the ongoing transformation of global capitalism, while also attentive to specific national and local contexts, industry characteristics, strategies of management, employers, unions, and the state. In order to provide an inside look at the daily factory life of auto workers and a deeper understanding of the roots rising labor unrest in the Chinese auto industry, I spent 20 months in 7 large auto assembly plants, including both state-owned and joint ventures, located in 6 Chinese cities. Between 2004 and 2011, I spent at least 2 months at each facility, talking with workers on the shop floor in worker group meetings, outside factories after work. I also interviewed managers, party and union cadres, government officials, labor arbitrators, scholars, and industry experts. For 2 months each, I worked at a state-owned truck factory, as well as a Sino-German joint venture, as newsletter editor run by the factory party committee. That work allowed me to observe how production was organized, what the working conditions were like, how people interacted with one another, and what kind of exchanges took place on a daily basis. Being present inside the factory every day certainly enriched my knowledge and understanding of complexity, nuance of the factory life. It also enabled me to contextualize what people said in their interviews and to identify the hidden and open forms of resistance on the shop floor. More importantly, I was able to document stories and events that would not be otherwise available to an outside researcher. This in-depth fieldwork provides the basis for the book's narrative and analysis of the transformation of the Chinese auto industry and its labor force, the worker regime and factory social care, the social compensation, wages, job security, the nature and extent of worker grievances and power, as well as their collective action. I also devoted much attention to the status operations, social consciousness of the farm workers and various temporary workers employed in great numbers in Chinese major assembly factories. Historically, auto workers are known for their strong workplace bargaining power and militancy in translating local struggles into major victories in broad labor movement. As a sociology Beverly Saber has studied, that treats major waves of auto workers throughout the 20th century, and argue that there has been a recurrent process whereby the geographic location production had created and strengthened the new working class and labor movements in each side of rapid industry expansion. With China becoming the new epicenter of the global automobile production, we see a similar combination of workers' great bargaining power and grievances have contributed to rising labor unrest in the Chinese auto industry. As many of you have been aware, the widely reported auto strike wave in 2010 is considered a turning point in Chinese workers' ongoing struggles for higher pay, better working conditions, and a junior union representation. Like most strikes in China, the strike was organized and by workers themselves. The factory union branch of the official union is ACFTU, not support or represent them in negotiations. The workers elect their own representatives to negotiate with management. The strike success in winning concessions from employers inspired a wave of strike in other auto parts plants in Guangdong, as well as in other manufacturing sectors and regions. The strikes clearly show that the workers in China are willing and able to organize collectively, stage strikes, and negotiate with management, despite their lack of independent labor unions and the right to strike under an authoritarian and repressive regime. But we have to ask, where is this labor right heading? How will labor relations in the auto industry and the broad political economy unfold in China in the coming decade? In answer to these questions, I identify the process at work in the Chinese auto industry today that are similar to observed elsewhere, but I also pointed to important dynamics that are specific to the Chinese case. Among the similar dynamics at work is a fundamental contradiction between legitimacy and profitability that has characterized capitalist development. Briefly speaking, efforts to enhance profitability tend to undermine social legitimacy and vice versa. Moreover, in China as elsewhere, companies and the state have tried to overcome this contradiction by joint boundaries and creating dependence with each labor force. For instance, treating one better than the other in terms of job security and other conditions. As I show in the book, however, this boundary jumping process creates renewed grievances and work resistance, especially among the excluded group temporary workers. Among the important elements specific to the Chinese case is time and condition as a sled later industrialization with strong revolutionary and state social legacy. In the context of rapid capitalist development and the communication of labor, this revolution and state legacy give rise to an even more acute legitimacy problem with the working class. Therefore, I'm also telling the story how this contradiction plays out at global, national, and shop floor levels within a specific industry at a time of hyper-speed growth in post-socialist China. Given I only have, I think, 25 minutes, I want to highlight three things that are central to understanding current and future of labor relations in the Chinese auto industry specifically and in China more generally. First, my evidence shows that the Chinese auto workers have gained great bargaining power amid the continued auto industry boom, increased scale and concentration of production, demographic shifts, and changes in state labor laws and policies. Moreover, the widely adopted just-in-time production system worldwide has increased the vulnerability for production to end interruptions in producing parts to assembling lines by eliminating the buffer. This turned to both the workplace bargaining power of both assembling and the parts workers along the global supply chain. As such, workers have become more embodied to redress grievances and demand better pay and working conditions from their employers. Moreover, facilitated by social media and labor rights activists, workers are increasingly well informed and organized, and they are able to stay united and elect their own union representatives to engage in collective bargaining. At the same time, China enters global competition in the mass production of automobile at the later stage of the product cycle, where competition is high and profit margins become thinner. The state-led industry restructuring since the late 1990s has increased the competition and driven automakers in China to prioritize profitability and move towards a leaner and a meaner working regime. Working conditions are characterized by heavy workload, intense work pace, long working hours, 10 to 12 hours per shift is very common in China, and excessive overtime. All the interviewed workers report physical strains and exhaustion of different degrees. The workers also expressed major grievances in increased intensity of work, reduced job security, the arbitrary exercise of management authority, the lack of advancement opportunities, and inferior status blue-collar workers in a hierarchy, factory, and social order. To be sure, Chinese auto workers' wages are about 30 to 50% higher than average manufacturing workers, even though they're still very low by international standards. But wage increase of frontline workers have not kept pace with macro growth of the auto industry in the past decade. Even this moderate wage increase was achieved primarily through overtime and increased work intensity. There was strong sentiment among the workers that they did not receive fair compensation and recognition for their work. I have a lot of interview quotes, but I won't read it here. But just to quick summarize, that it is clear that Chinese auto industry has not formed a long-term normalized wage increase mechanism consistent with the rapid growth of the industry and in labor productivity, a situation faced by Chinese workers at large. On the other hand, as one of China's peer industries of strategic importance, the auto assembly industry has been under direct state intervention. By controlling personal decisions of senior Chinese managers through country manager personal system at large SOEs and joint ventures, central government can ensure that those enterprises carry out the economic and political agenda consistent with the goal of party state. That is, to increase profitability while maintaining peaceful and cooperative labor relations. So this contradiction pressure on the country managers in those major auto makers in China adopt policy of labor force dualism that draws boundaries between formal workers and temporary workers. By labor force dualism, I refer to a labor system that deploys formal and temporary workers side by side on production lines, having them perform similar or identical tasks, but subject them to different treatment. Formal workers have high wages, more generous benefits, and relatively secure employment as a management effort within their cooperation. Conversely, temporary workers have more wages, fewer benefits, and little job security as a strategy to lower costs and increase profitability. It resembles the two-tier system implemented in the U.S. auto industry. Although the second-tier workers in the U.S. are not temporary workers, but they are still treated as second-class working citizens. Among the seven automobile factories I studied, six of them include a large number of temporary workers, ranging between one-third to two-thirds of their total production workforce. Notably, temporary workers used to be peasant workers hired from the countryside in the near, close to automobile factories. But since late 1990s, with the rise of the labor dispatching, which is known as temporary agency work, temporary workers have been increasingly supplied by labor dispatch agencies. Those workers signed contracts with those agencies but are sent to work at the automobile factories. Many of them have actually worked at the auto factory for more than 5 years, but they're still considered agency workers. They're not entitled to the benefits offered by the factory, and they can be returned to the agencies if they're no longer needed without any severance compensation. During my research, I found about two-thirds of temporary workers were those temporary agency workers. The remaining mutant intern workers who were used by employers as full-time temporary workers. So they're actually not supposed to be as full-time workers, but because of gray area about the internship, so many students were used as full-time workers. In fact, labor for feudalism has re-emerged as a widespread practice in large capital-intensive enterprises in China since early 2000. Since dualism was introduced to lower cost and increase staff flexibility, at the same time trying to gain consent and cooperation from former workers, but it created unintended consequences. For one thing, the management contract division among workers continuously driven a new generation of temporary workers who are increasingly urban and better educated to protest against unequal treatment. To the extent that assembling plants are able to provide job security and relative high wages to those core former workers, they push down job insecurity and the cost-cutting measures either to plant suppliers or by constructing new labor within the assembling plants. It is not a surprise coincidence that the main source of militancy has so far resided among the part workers in subcontracting system and among temporary workers in the assembly plant. But under the highly integrated just-in-time production system, the strikes by part suppliers, by part workers, and by temporary workers can effectively shut down the assembly plant and the entire production chain. In the book, I documented various hidden open forms of resistance by auto workers in the form of sabotage, slowdowns, effort bargaining, filing labor dispute cases, and white-collar strikes. In particular, I witnessed rising activism among temporary workers against unequal treatment. Given the structural constraints of Chinese workers, including the lack of independent unions and right to strike, how are workers able to gain some confidence and control and mobilize on the ground? How are workers, and what accounts for the rising worker activism, especially among temporary workers, who are often perceived as weak, vulnerable, but docile, trying to be controlled to their lack of job security? So there are several reasons. First, as mentioned before, auto workers have gained growing bargaining power. Workplace bargaining power. Even temporary workers, because they're large networks on assembly lines, they have actually bargaining power to shut down the production. So two of the strikes can clearly show that when temporary workers organize to stop working, the full assembly line will be affected. Second, the recomposition workforce contributed to the rising activism. After the restructuring, the formal production workers, most were semi-skilled urban young workers with a minimum of 12-year education and 3-year renewable contracts. The new temporary workers, agency and student workers, they were a mixture of local, urban, and rural youth with better education and a safe ride. They have similar education and skill levels compared to formal production workers. This blurs the boundaries between formal and temporary workers, previously based on the rural urban hukou system. So now, because temporary workers are increasingly urban, so they have a very similar background to these formal workers. So this contributed to the rising activism among temporary workers against the unequal treatment. And third, I cannot show the slide, but the work group centered mass assembly production and worker collaboration at work facilitated group-based solidarity. This is a kind of labor process that generates solidarity. So China is like many other auto factories that the production is organized by groups. So the group members, they work together and they socialize together. So it's easy to organize solidarity along in the production process. More importantly, fourth, is that this factory provided voluntary residents can facilitate workers' mobilization and action. So we all know that the dormitory labor regime that has been extensively in the literature is often regarded as an effective means of management control over workers. But in the auto industry, in my case, I found they become a hotbed to facilitate worker mobilization and collective action. A large number of young male workers with similar background and workplace experience did together in a concentrated factory dorms, allows them to build social networks, initiate collective actions, and stay connected during strikes. Lastly, the young generation of Chinese workers, they are very technological savvy, and they are adept at using internet and social media such as QQ, WeChat, microblog, online forums, and text messages to spread information, initiate collective actions, and stay connected during the strikes. So given the wide post labor post dualism, which created inequality and divisions among workers, the big questions concerning the outcome of worker resistance depend on whether temporary workers are able to make a common cause or they end up fighting against each other. In the book, I compare two wide-scale strikes by temporary workers with different outcomes. Both strikes broke out in a spontaneous manner by several hundred student workers staying at their dorms and refusing to go to work. Both strikes were fueled by the sense of injustice with directable economic gains. The June strike was initiated by the delay of workers' monthly wages. It was spontaneous and defensive in nature. In the second October strike, temporary workers demanded for an equal wage increase after the factory raised formal workers' wages.
Wait a minute, Luke. Hold on.
Striking workers will fight, and temporary workers only got a side raise 2 months later. There were several factors accounted for the different outcomes of the two strikes, such as timing, management, perceptions of strikes. I found the major, the most important factor is whether or not formal workers support temporary workers' struggles. In the June strike, the shared workplace grievances motivated formal workers to stand along with temporary workers. In the October strike, however, the divisive wage policy that only raised formal workers' wages detached formal workers from supporting temporary workers. We can see that temporary workers' struggles are more likely to succeed when their grievances are shared by formal workers and receive support from the formal workers. In spite of divisive labor force dualism, my evidence suggests that the relationship between formal and temporary workers were characterized by a dynamic rather than antagonism. This was largely due to the group-based solidarity enabled in the labor process and the fact that there hadn't been open replacement of formal workers with temporary workers. Therefore, little direct competition and confrontation between the two groups of workers over jobs. Also, the socially egalitarian legacies were still relevant to both the workers and the managers. These factors indicate the possibility of developing a more engaging and cooperative relationship between the two groups of workers. To be sure, my evidence suggests that auto workers relatively high wages and perceived difficulty in finding better alternatives, combined with the lack of independent unions and collective bargaining, have inhibited many workers from openly confronting management. However, workers' localized struggles have won specific management concessions, including higher wages and benefits for both formal and technical workers. Moreover, by seeking auto worker resistance within the broader national context of rising labor unrest with China's rapid capitalist development, I show how Beijing's concern with maintaining social stability and political legitimacy have led to the passage of new labor laws to stabilize labor relations and pacify grievant aggrieved workers. The labor contract law, for example, devoted one section and 11 articles to regulating labor dispatch and provide some legal protections for temporary agency workers. Although compromise in the lawmaking process has led to entrenched dualism and inequality between formal and temporary workers, the ongoing battle over amendment to the labor contract law suggests that Chinese labor policy is not a settled fact. Rather, it is a dynamic process as a party state by this balance between promoting labor flexibility and profitability and maintaining stability and legitimacy with an increasingly restive working class. In conclusion, I want to highlight a few theoretical implications. First, my study showed that even labor unrest in China has not led to a formation of independent union or competitive political parties that challenge the authoritarian party state at the national level. Widespread grassroots resistance have succeeded in winning substantial wage increases and improved working conditions for workers on the shop floor. Moreover, rising labor unrest has induced the party state to introduce new labor laws and policy changes that extend new rights for workers as part of its effort to stabilize labor relations and maintain social stability. A direct related question is where Chinese workers' localized labor unrest will lead, and whether it can push for the establishment of independent union and a collective bargaining. My research has led me to a dynamic view that workers' grassroots projects will continue to push for higher wages, better working conditions, and more union organizing and labor reform from the central government and official unions. But the Communist Party is unlikely to allow any independent union to exist out of its control. The ACLU, especially at the grassroots level, is likely to become more active in responding to workers' grievances and demand, and the threat that it would become totally irrelevant to workers and state if it cannot deliver any meaningful gains for workers and thereby mitigating labor capital conflicts and preempt strikes. We should also recognize there are a wide range of organizations, such as labor centers, activist groups, labor NGOs, that have played an important role in supporting workers in their struggles, providing legal and practical advice, and helping them to conduct collective bargaining and maintain unity and solidarity during strikes and protests. On the other hand, the Chinese government remains firmly in charge, and it has taken an increasingly more repressive approach to worker activists and labor NGOs and rights groups in the face of the economic downturn. We can discuss more about the recent development during the Q&A section, what's the implication for labor activism in China today. So all this reminds us that national context and historical legacies matter. We should not assume that organizing strategies, patterns, rhetoric, and dynamics of work for the labor movement and the general improvement of worker welfare in China are the same as wisdom generated from the experience of the core countries. For one thing, the revolutionary and socialist legacies of the Communist Party and continued official adherence to such legacies have played and will continue to play an important role in shaping the mobilizing strategies, patterns, languages, and outcome of labor protest in today's China. It is true, as Furman has rightly pointed out in his review in on my book, that we need a larger oppositional framework that that posed an alternative vision of the social transformation based on class perspective with forms of a conscious class organization in order to achieve more. This is not an easy task, particularly in China's current situation. But for activists and socialist scholars, the first step in that direction, I think, is to understand labor struggles in China from the bottom up, starting with prospective workers and their experience. We should also need to close monitor the state actors and their logics and strategies. And then try to develop a set of analytical tools that are historically and geographically grounded that can help us identify the potential for transformation from below. We also need to pay close attention to the intensified boundary jogging dynamic in an age of labor precarity. Today, workers everywhere have been confronted with growing job insecurity and inequality between a shrinking segment of poor workers and an ever-expanding population of non-regular workers. A telling example is a widespread two-tier system in almost every sector, including higher education, where faculty members are divided between tenure-track professors and non-tenure-track adjuncts and part-time lecturers. A central position question for labor movement everywhere is to find a common ground and to build solidarity across different boundaries to struggle for a more just, equitable, and inclusive world both in the workplace and in our society at large. Let me end on a positive note. If China ever manages to make it onto a more sustainable and equitable development path, the ongoing struggles by Chinese workers for dignity and justice will no doubt have played a critical role in taking us there. Thank you.